You're listening to Treasured Memories. Researched and presented by Mary Curie, recorded and produced by Shirley O'Regan for West Limerick 102 FM. Now, welcome to episode 5 of Treasured Memories. Mary, we're jogging along, aren't we?
We're flying along, yes, yes. Today we're going to be talking about people who are buried in St. David's graveyard, and their occupations were somehow or other linked with communications. So either the earlier days, the postal service, or later on, telegraphy, or Morse code, or so on.
And most of these professions lost to us now.
Yeah, quite many, or just purely historic. I mean, recently there during COVID, when we couldn't attend funerals, I actually started writing letters of condolence to people because it was just difficult to get around. And I suddenly realised I hadn't written a letter in years.
Isn't it a lovely thing? I write letters, but I'm peculiar. I write letters, or I type them on aged machines. People still get missives from me, even though I'm forever yes. Cribbing about the cost of stamps, because why do they go up four times in 1 year?
They are shocking now. It's expensive. Yeah. Actually, when it started out too, post was very expensive. It started like the late 1600s, early 1700s, but it was only for the aristocracy.
Yes.
Because when you were doing the social circuit, you had to send out invitations for people to come to the ball at your premises.
Ah, of course.
And then, of course, they sent a reply to you. And then afterwards, they'd send a thank you for staying the weekend.
And if they visited and you weren't there, they would leave calling cards. Oh, such lovely things.
Oh, lovely things. So all of this required a postal service. And the postal service at the time was charged by weight and by distance.
Ah.
So first of all, they'd weigh your letter. And if it was one sheet, it was only a penny, and two sheets and so on. Four sheets weighed an ounce in the envelope. So it must be a very good quality paper. And then the distance was so many miles, to 5 miles, to 10 miles, to 20, and so on. And if you were posting to England, it was so much more. So it was very expensive to send a letter to anyone. And this kind of goes on until about the 1820s, when a man decides, maybe we should have a stamp, just one charge for everyone, and then more people could write letters.
And the admin would be a heck of a lot easier as well, wouldn't
yeah.
it? You wouldn't be weighing everything. And
so by the time it actually comes together, it's about the 1830s, and sure. Out comes the penny black. So this is a famous stamp. And at first, when you went in to get your penny black, they had to have the scissors to cut it out. And it takes another 10 years before a man invents perforated paper.
Imagine the joy of it.
Tear it off, yes. And the self-adhesive back. So these were all great.
So you're not
innovations.
Having to cut it out with the scissors and glue it on yourself
stick
at home.
It on. Yeah. So finally, then they start rolling these postal services out. And this really opens up the country. And it,
of course.
I mean, you had to have the expense of putting on a mail coach. And then they thought, well, let's charge people to go on the mail coach. And first, they are very expensive. To go from Dublin to Cork on the coach, you had to book your place, you had to get the ticket, and it was 2 guineas.
That's expensive.
Steep. This
yeah.
is like 1800. Yeah. So again, it was very expensive at the start, but the more they do it, the more they roll it out, the cheaper it gets, and it becomes a regular thing. So we find in Pigott's directory for 1822, it says there's a post office in the square, and the postmaster and stamp distributor is Mr. John Gunn. So I was wondering if this is the same John Gunn who built all those lovely buildings.
Along the square, yeah.
Along the square. So it probably is, because it's an unusual name. He came originally from Ratu. You know, there's that round tower in Kerry?
Ah,
yes.
He
came down from there. And as well as that, he also had a draper's and a wool manufacturing shop in the square. So obviously he wasn't making enough money just out of the postal service on its own. And he says here that the mail from Dublin, Limerick, Waterford is dispatched at 5 in the morning and arrives at 4:30 in the afternoon. So
that's good going, isn't it?
Blimey, they have to be up at 5 in the morning to get the mail out, so he'd be there in his dressing gown, I suppose.
Yes.
Which sounds awfully early, but off it goes. And twice, so once in the morning, and it's coming in the evening then. And the mail from Abbeyfield leaves at 6 in the morning on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays, and arrives on alternate days at 6 in the evening. So there you go. Then the directories don't list Newcastle West for the next 40 years. So the last directory for Newcastle West is 1867, Pigott's. And it mentions that George Roach is now the postmaster. And the post arrives at 6:15 and departs at 6:15 p.m. And it also says George Roach is in Bridge Street and he's a grocer and a spirit dealer. And the population of Newcastle at the time was 2,449. Earlier in the 1822, when it said the population was 4,000, but I think that's the outlying area.
Sure, it must have been.
I think that's taking in the whole countryside, Mm-hmm. Anyway, George Roach, stays on as a postmaster and post stamp deliverer and all that. From 1867, he's still there in 1880. And then in 1886, we have a change. 1886, the postmaster and stamp distributor by that stage was John D. Moylan. So I just mentioned that George Roach is a Stone 150, so he's up here in Churchtown. John Moylan also, he's at Stone 883. As well as being postmaster, they now have another person employed there, and she's listed in the directory as Mary O'Connor, as a telegraphist.
Modernity has arrived.
Modernity has arrived. Now, the telegraph was based on Morse code, and Morse code was invented by Samuel Morse in America in 1844. And it's kind of famous from Westerns. You always see the guy in the post office sending, hoping the cavalry arrive before the Indians kind of thing, and tap, tap, tapping. And it's on the train services it becomes most used. Telling when trains are going to arrive. And then it's used in the financial services when stocks are going up and down to notify people. And finally, they put in a transatlantic line, and it comes in at Mizenhead in Ireland. And this then becomes the line for all of Europe. And this becomes the most important place. You can imagine. This is amazing stuff.
It's cutting-edge technology cutting of its day, isn't it?
Technology, yeah.
It's Morse the internet code of its day.
Yeah. The shortest Morse code message was sent by an Irishman. Can we guess who? Oscar Wilde.
Of course.
And it's open inverted commas, question mark, close inverted commas. We're not told who he sends it to, but then he gets back the reply. And it's open inverted commas, exclamation mark, close inverted commas. Another famous one was from Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens. He was in London, and the rumour went around in America that he was dead. And he sent a famous telegram saying, rumours of my demise are being greatly exaggerated. the first one was sent from Washington to Baltimore, and it just said, I mean, Samuel Morse must have been a religious man, because it just says, what God has wrath. So I'm not sure. Anyway, that was the first one. That was from Washington. He went from the Senate in Washington to Baltimore. There you go. So telegraphy takes off, and basically this is just short messages, either wishing someone a happy birthday, very important at weddings.
Weddings, yes.
The big one, and sometimes at funerals to send your condolences. But by 1919, there are 6 million telegrams delivered in Ireland.
It's amazing.
6 million, So every post office hired postal boys, little boys on bikes.
On bikes to bring
and
out the telegrams.
The important thing was it was delivered quickly. So if you sent a telegram from Galway to Dublin, it was guaranteed to be delivered within the hour.
Isn't that fantastic?
Amazing, you know? Amazingly quick. Obviously, it takes on a new role, if you like, because World War One is happening at the time, and people were dreading seeing the telegram boy coming.
Of course.
Because, as I mentioned,
Yeah.
40 people are listed as having died in World War One in the Castle West area. So as many more must have gone out and served there, and they're all fingers crossed thinking, Please don't stop at my house.
They don't want a telegram.
Telegrams stay with us, and they're right there, right up until 2013. They finally closed the telegram offices. Because text and email have come
in. Of course. Like, we can instantly message each other now, so we don't need somebody else to bring our message in an hour on a bicycle.
That's right. That's right.
As nice and as quaint as it might be.
That's right, yeah.
I'd love to receive a telegraph.
Yeah. It's a nice happy one, yeah.
Exactly.
So anyway, John D. Moylan takes over the role, and like I said, he also has a telegraphy there. George Roach is still down as being in Bridge Street grocer at the same time. So maybe this might be his son who doesn't take over the post office.
Okay.
When Moylan's moves in. Right. And John D. Moylan also has a stationer's and a bookseller's on Bishop Street. So he's got another string to his bow. So the Irish Telegraph Service started in 1870. I was running by the post office. excuse me. Right, so I've done that Mark Twain. I've mentioned Mark Twain and Oscar Wilde. Oops, switch for the page. Right, so a telephone then. The telephone was invented by Alexander Graham Bell, and he patented his telephone in 1877. The postmaster was still John Moylan, and on his demise, his widow Catherine became postmistress. Now, that was very unusual. Usually it went to another man or another family, but this time it stayed in the family, and she took over, and that's in 1908. And then their daughter Catherine was also worked the Morse machine, the telegraphy.
So they kept it in the family?
They kept it in the family. And outside, the young lads that they had cycling for them and carrying the mail was Charles Hines and his brother Patrick. So they were telegram boy, delivery boys. Both the Hines family are interred at Stone 844 and Stone 59. Patrick later, he grew up and he emigrated to America, where he married Dolly Hutchinson. And she was from Newcastle West also. And her father, William Hutchinson, was the telegraph linesman.
So
he walked the lines, checked the wires and repaired the wires and all that kind of thing. So again, it's all the same family.
It's kind of a clique,
yeah,
isn't
just
it?
Just like we found it with the railways.
With the railway people, yeah. Railway people married railway people.
That's it, yeah. Now here we have the same with the telegrams. Charles then grew up from being a telegram delivery boy to being a postman. And the postal service, if you like, the postal service starts out and people are on their donkey and cart delivering post because they have quite a long route to go.
Of course.
Sometimes they're going all the way from Newcastle out to nearly Turnafulla.
And often a great distance between houses, like the neighbours wouldn't be next door neighbours.
That's right, long, long distances. But after World War One, they get bicycles, or actually during World War One, they get bicycles, and they start cycling to deliver the mail. And at this stage, the postman is someone that you really look forward to seeing because he doesn't just shove it through the door and go. He knocks on the door.
There's a social aspect
to it. And
then
he hands you the letter and says, that's from New York. Is that your sister, Kathleen? And here's one from Toronto. Is that so? And they have a good old chat about everybody. And then he tells you who got letters next door and who she's been talking to and so on. And then there are always those rumours about mail being steamed open and people knowing everyone else's business before they should do. So it was a completely different world, if you like. But changes were coming. And another change that happened was that mail was now going to be delivered by air. And this starts in France. And the famous flyer or pilot in France was Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the guy who wrote The Little Prince.
The Little Prince, yeah.
And he was flying a seaplane from France to Algeria and Morocco. And then also taking people, but also then bringing back stuff like oranges and dates and exotic fruits and spices and more mail coming back. And he writes about his journeys, and he writes about the romance of the desert and the sun and the dunes and all this kind of stuff. And it's a whole new world, if you like. Okay, but we still have ordinary postmen as well. We've got postman John A. Lee. He has Stone 241. He was born 1895, died in 1980. And he was postman in Kerry for nearly 45 years.
Amazing. So you must have known every single thing about every single person in the parish.
I just think he must have been a very fit man because there isn't much flat ground in Kerry.
There is something. You're always either climbing up or struggling down.
That's right. And he had his bicycle. And he replaced Mr. Madigan, who was his father-in-law. So again, we've got the family
post
connection.
People marrying post people.
So Matt Madigan had been doing it around the turn of the century. And his payment of time was a princely salary of 6 shillings and 8 pence a week. Wow.
And as I say, fairly interesting terrain to be travelling for that.
Okay. Now, as well as delivering the mail by seaplane, of course we have Foynes seaplanes there. They also had a Met office in Foynes and they had a radio tower. And the radio tower was connected to a radio tower in Rhinanna, and both of those were connected to a radio tower in Newfoundland. And between the three radio towers, they were able to send messages that they were receiving from ships telling what the weather was like out in the Atlantic. And then they were able to fairly accurately predict also by keeping in touch with the planes if they were following the right line and if they needed to, you know, alter their position slightly because they were slightly off course. So these were incredibly important people. The Met office in 1939 had 17 employees. But obviously, as the flights increased during the war, the numbers increased. And One of the Met Office people there was Paul Rodham Brown, and he married Mae McCoy. And Mae McCoy is buried at Stone 537, Mae McCoy Brown. So her husband was in the Met Office in Foynes during the war years.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's amazing all the tie-ins you get with all of these people. All right, so the telephone arrives then. First of all, the telephone is just in the post office. And if you wanted to make a phone call, you had to go in there
and do it.
Book a phone call and do it. Then it gradually gets into the hotels, the creamery, all the business places, if you like, the solicitor's office, the doctors, and so on. It isn't really rolled out to the general public until about the 1960s. What comes maybe just around the same time are public phone boxes.
Ah.
I think there was one opposite the church here. There's certainly one in the square in Newcastle.
Yes.
I remember that one.
Outside the square house.
That's right, the square house, exactly. But I remember the telephones that we had. We got a Bakelite phone, first of all.
And with the rotary dial.
Yeah, rotary dial. And you'd wind up this thing inside. And I remember being very young and picking up the handset and listening. And you'd hear a voice the other end saying, "Put that phone down. I'll tell your father." I just think that was hilarious to lift up the phone. But I remember once my mum had booked a phone call, and this is before 65 because my granny was still alive. And she'd booked a phone call to America to say Happy Christmas to her sister in New York. And we were at home, and knock came to the door, and it was Mrs. Brown. And she said, "Your call is coming through from New York. Can you come up to the post office?"
Ah.
So my mum had to take off her apron, put on her good shoes,
and
put on
up.
Her good coat, put on her hat, and go out, get the bike, and cycled up to Arda. And then she kind of threw the bike aside and went in. And she got the call, came through after a few minutes, and she was saying, "Hello, Kathleen." And there was like a 3-second pause. And then she could hear the voice at the other end. And then she kind of became aware that Miss Cahill's were listening in and the people in the post office were listening in, and she became very self-conscious. And she said it was a dreadful call because she just got so aware that everyone was listening in to the call.
So you couldn't really say anything at all.
So when she came home then, Granny was saying, "Did you ask them about the Duffys, and did you ask her about the whatever?"
Oh yeah.
And Mum said, "Oh no, I couldn't think of anything. I couldn't think what to say." And so, "You're pure useless. Why did you say such a So it was very limited. But anyway, when we got the Bakelite phone, it was a party line at first. And there was only 5 houses down our road, so everyone was on the line.
Yes.
So we were 1 ring, the McMahons, 2 rings, the Enrights, 3 rings was the Listons, 4 rings was the McCormicks, I think. That was it. 4 of us. And the thing was, you could pick up the phone and listen in. Yeah, and you could listen into what everyone else was saying, or they could listen into you, and usually you could hear, because you could hear a click, and you hear a click, you'd know,
and
someone,
you know,
else,
someone else is
up.
On the line. Yeah.
Because you weren't really sure, did I miss the first ring, was that 2 rings, was that me? So you'd go and lift up maybe by mistake, you
yeah
know? And my mother once say, I could hear her saying it, "Will you put that phone down?" She was also clicked, someone else was. So party lines were not a great idea. So finally private lines came in, and I remember our number was Arda 22.
Ah.
So I remember the creamery, I think, was the post office was 1, the creamery I think was 2 or 3, then the parish priest, and I'm not sure who was after that, but we were 22. And then what happened next was, that was a manual exchange.
Sure.
So you'd see people pulling in plugs and pulling out plugs.
And there's
and
great footage
you.
Of that, isn't there? This great yeah. video footage of telephonists, and an incredibly complex thing to be doing.
I would say so.
And literally physically connecting the calls to each other.
Yeah. And the thing is, if you wanted connection some places, you had to wait until there was a break in ads on television, because you knew they'd be watching something, they wouldn't bother connecting you.
Yes.
So you had to wait. But then finally, the final manual exchange closed in 1987, as recent as that.
As
I'm
recent
amazed.
As that, isn't that
yeah.
amazing?
And then it
I know
went
that
automatic.
The poet Michael Hartnett worked for a time as a telephonist. He worked once somebody was introducing him to Desmond Fitzgerald, they said, "This is Desmond Fitzgerald, Knight of Glyn," and he said, "Hello, I'm Michael Hartnett, Knight Telephonist."
Okay, oh, that's very good. Okay, so anyway, they switched over, but it had kind of gone digital, I think, in Dublin about 1971
sure.
until 1987. And at that stage, our phones were in the doldrums. For some reason, you had to wait 2 years if you wanted to get a phone at that stage.
Amazing, isn't it?
There was an incredibly long queue. And even if you were a doctor, you had a 6 month waiting list because they were just so far behind the times. But suddenly there was a big push on, and I think just when Flanagan, remember he later became Prime Minister?
Oh yes,
Oliver. He did something. He radicalised the telephone system.
Like it has to have some sort of expediency because it's not.
I think it was a union problem. And anyway, he got it sorted out. But in a sense, what it superseded the phones really was mobiles came in the 1990s. And the first one was like the size of a shoebox. Even though it was mobile, it's a huge thing.
Barely mobile. Mobile in the sense that some of my portable typewriters are portable. They're portable, but you wouldn't go far with them.
That's it. Yeah. You wouldn't be a weightlifter to carry them.
You wouldn't be walking around the town with the thing.
So anyway, the mobiles came in, and the other amazing thing that came in was sending, not text, what do you call them, faxes.
Yes.
Faxes were amazing. I remember being actually in employment and seeing the first fax. And we used to send reports to America from the company I was working in, and they took anything between 2 weeks to 3 weeks to get whatever we had sent them. And now suddenly,
and I could do it instantly.
Just like that.
Yeah, somebody at the other end was seeing it.
Within 5 minutes, and it's just... It was so scary. You kind of thought, oh my God, the world is so small. We thought, there won't be any need for international flights anymore because you can send faxes. You don't need, don't need meetings or anything. You can just fax everything. And it just seemed incredibly modern and technologically.
Such an amazing thing. And now, of course, we have email, so we don't even need the paperwork with that. We can just send digital copies of everything instantly.
That's right, yeah. And Zoom meetings as well. Yeah, it's just, the change has been so 100%. So it's
if you think in terms of like your mother's horrible phone call with her sister in New York versus a Zoom call, like how much would they have appreciated that? Being able to see each other, being able to do it from your own living room.
That's
you know?
Right, yeah. I suppose the main thing too was the fact that her sister was an American, had children the same age as us, but she rarely saw them.
Mm.
So just to see them growing up, you know, and have that connection, that would have been lovely, yeah. Of course, the one thing I kind of forgot to mention here is that as well as these, the other thing that came in that was a big change was transistors and radios.
Sure.
They made a huge change. My uncle told me once about when he was a small lad, they had no transistor at home at the time or radio. And if there was an All-Ireland on, the thing was to go up to the barracks. And the door was always open. He said, you just went in and sat down on the former, which is just a bench. Yes. You sit along there like you're waiting. And everyone else would be there. And they'd get out two kind of metal cylinder, or the little cylinders, whatever, and warm them up, then put them into the radio, like a bit of a palaver, and then tune it in, you'd hear the crackling, and then you'd hear it, you know, you'd hear the Artane Boys band and everything, and they'd sit there and they'd listen to the match, and then they'd go on home again afterwards. But he said it was a routine thing to do if there was something big going on.
That they knew that they would put it on and they'd all go up there.
That's right, yeah. So that was his earliest memory of radio.
The thing that kind of strikes me, kind of come to the end of this, is that the better technology gets, the less social we become.
That's right.
You know, because we're in our own houses now, sending our own emails, and you know we don't need to go to a communal place to listen to the radio. We don't need to go to the post office to try and make a horrible phone call to people.
No.
Do you know? So I mean, there are advantages but disadvantages. Like there's a charming sense of community in all of the previous iterations, I think, of communication.
Yeah.
That we're kind of losing gradually, aren't we?
That's true. Yeah, I like Morse code, I suppose, because I have a lot of memories about it because my dad, before he became a farmer, for 4 years, he was with the Merchant Marines and he was the radio officer on board ship. So he knew Morse code. And he said a few times that he remembered really strikingly. One was when he was at anchor in the Bay of Biafra, which is, you know, if you're looking at Africa, it's just sort of on the west coast. Okay. He was on the same line of longitude as Ireland.
Okay.
And it was 1948, and he was able to tune in and get the All-Ireland final. I forget which match it was, but he said it was like the commentator was right beside him. He said it was just crystal clear.
Yeah.
Because he was on the same line of longitude. Yeah. And it's an amazing kind of story there. The downside of being the radio officer was that the ship couldn't leave port unless he was on board.
So
he rarely got leave to go.
So you're literally tied to it. You're literally tied to it.
Yeah. So he got to Rome and he knew he was going to be in Rome whatever time, September of whatever, 51. And he agreed to meet my mother there. They were engaged to be married. and they thought they'd both like to do Rome together.
Yes.
But the captain wouldn't let him off the ship. So my mother was alone in Rome.
No.
But anyway, she got around. She, you know, she was well able.
Yeah, but still.
But, yeah, he was a bit miffed about that. But that was the reason why. Because, and then when he came back to Ireland, he was still fascinated by Morse code and ham radio. So he had a big tower over our house. And it looked like, pylon over our house, just so he could pick up Morse code and he could pick up, if there's any ships at difficulty or whatever, he could pick up their signals and listen into really strange conversations over the airwaves. And he's forever, he's just real ham radio enthusiast. And of course, the most famous use of the radio probably was the Titanic. But they were sending all these messages, and the ship nearby got tired of all the chatter, so they switched off their radio. And as a result of the Titanic disaster, there were kind of three rulings brought in. One was that you're never allowed to switch off your radio. Mm-hmm. Two, you always had to have a radio officer. And three, SOS signal. They had to go do radio silence every hour on the hour or something to check for any SOSs in the area, kind of thing.
You see, you never think you need these safety measures until you do.
Yeah, absolutely right, yeah. So, I mean, radio does save lives. There was one other occasion, actually. It's just one of my uncles, my granduncle, was mining in a place called Nogales, which is just opposite, it's just south of the border in Mexico, opposite, I can't remember the name of the place, in Texas. No, it's gone. But anyway, they were striking for better pay. And he decided at that stage he didn't want to be involved in the strike, so he came back to Ireland. And unfortunately, the mine owners didn't want to strike either. So what they did was they hired these thugs, basically, and they said, round up all those strikers and put them on the train and just lose them. So they did this. They went in to where these guys are striking, into the square. They rounded up 200 people, put them on a train, sent it out to the desert.
And dropped them off.
Dropped them off. Unfortunately, what they picked up were some were men and women who were out shopping, had nothing to do with it. One of them was a journalist who knew how to do Morse code. So he said, we're on the track, don't worry anyone, I'll walk along here, I'll come to a pole, I'll send Morse code. So he does this, shinnies up a pole, taps out his Morse code, we're trapped here in the desert, sends it to the New York Times.
Fantastic.
The New York Times picks up the story, says, you know, how appalling is this? These men were arrested, the mine owners, and they were found guilty of kidnapping and all kinds of things. They served 5 days in jail.
Fantastic.
Because they were wealthy guys. They got
This is why it's important to know Morse code.
That's why it's important to know Morse code.
So I suppose that's episode... That's episode five?
I think five, yes. Five, possibly. Yes. I can count.
We're getting there. You have been listening to Treasured Memories, researched and presented by Mary Curie, recorded and produced by Shirley O'Regan for West Limerick 102 FM.